Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, we have been studying the Sutta Nipata, and last time I started to explain the Parabhava Sutta. This is the sutta called Downfall. The sutta takes the form of a dialogue between a deva, that's a deity, and the Buddha. And on one occasion, in the middle of the night, this deity comes to the Buddha. This is a typical event, since every night, it said, the deities from different world systems would come to the Buddha to ask questions. And so on this particular night, the deity came to the Buddha and asked him about a person who suffers downfall and asks about the causes of downfall. And then the Buddha begins to explain one by one the causes of downfall. Each time the Buddha will explain one type of downfall, then the deity will accept the answer and then go on to ask about another cause of downfall. And so altogether the sutta takes, I think, about 12 causes of downfall. Though I should say 12 verses dealing with the causes of downfall, since in some verses several causes of downfall are mentioned. And 2 weeks ago, in my discourse, I dealt with the first half of the sutta, which takes us up through verse number 12 in the sutta. And so this time we come to verse number 14. In the translation published by Venerable Dr. Saddhatisa, he does not repeat the translation of the verse of the deity's questions, since each time it's the same verse, except the number of the downfall just differs. And so we have only the translation of the answers. So I will recite the Pali and then give the translation. And I'll begin with the question for verse number 103. Iti hetaṃ vijānāma chata moso parābhavo satamang bhagava bruhi king parabhavato mukhang. Okay, this means we understand the sixth cause of downfall. Please, O Blessed One, explain to me the seventh. What is the cause of downfall? Okay, and then the Buddha answers, chati tado tana tado gota tado chayo naro sangnya ting ati manyeti tangparabhavato mukhang. Okay, the meaning of this, I'll follow the text here. If a man is conceited through his birth, through wealth or community and looks down on his own kith and kin, well, let us say on his own relatives, this is a cause of one's downfall. Okay, so this verse is dealing with, we call it pride or conceit as a cause of downfall. And here he's pointing out certain causes of pride which were particularly prevalent in the India of his time. India at that time, like most traditional societies, was a rather rigidly stratified society. There was a society divided first into four main social classes. At the top, according to one reckoning, were the Brahmins. Then came the Kshatriyas, or rulers. Then the commercial classes, the businessmen, landowners. And then at the bottom came the workers, servile class. And then below them were the outcasts, those who were not included within the class system. And so those who were born into either the Brahmin class or the Kshatriya class, particularly certain families within these classes, would pride themselves on their birth and look down upon those from other social classes. And so in this way, birth becomes a source of pride. Wealth tends to be a universal source of pride for many people. And then clan, according to this text, Gotra, was a subdivision within the general caste system or class system. Certain clans were regarded as especially prestigious, and so those who belonged to these clans would pride themselves on their clan membership and despise those from other clans. In our own time, we might not have particular problem with birth as a cause of pride or clan as a cause of pride, though there might even be that problem in American society, since there might be certain families, for example, those who have been, whose ancestry in the United States goes back to the time of the American Revolution or even the pre-revolutionary period. They pride themselves on being long-standing American families. Then they look down upon those whose families came to the USA in the 19th century, 20th century, or even within the past few years. They look upon them as being immigrants who don't really have properly belong to America, who can't be true Americans. And so in this way, birth can become a source of pride even for us in 20th century America. But what tends to be sources of pride for us in this so-called egalitarian or democratic society is not so much birth, but social class. So we have, even though we claim to have an open, mobile society, but those who are in the higher social classes, wealthier classes, will pride themselves on their membership in these classes and look down upon those who are just blue-collar workers, those who are working at clerical jobs, those who are self-employed, and then they think, since we might be wealthy, having our own business, we might be wealthy, we might have prestigious professions, lawyers, medical doctors, engineers, professors, so we are high class, the others low class. And so class does become a source of pride. Wealth becomes a source of pride. Those in the upper income brackets look down upon those in the lower income brackets. education becomes a source of pride. One gets a higher degree, master's degree, doctorate degree, then one looks down on those without higher education. Those who have certain special gifts, special talents, pride themselves on their talents. Those who have special intelligence, pride themselves on their intelligence. Those who become famous, well-known, popular, pride themselves on their fame, popularity, and so on. So all of these causes, all of these factors become causes or bases of pride, things that we grasp upon, seize upon, and on that basis we reinforce our sense of identity and make this a point for ranking ourselves as being higher, better, superior to others, and then we look down upon others who don't have the same standards, that may have the same credentials that we ourselves possess. Okay, so what are the particular pitfalls or dangers in pride that it should be singled out as a cause of downfall? First of all, I would say that pride increases the gulf or gap between ourselves and others. And so, because of pride, in our own minds, we tend to polarize our experience of the world into a confrontational relationship between ourselves on the one side, others on the other side. And once this confrontational relationship is established, then our primary mode of relating to others is that of rivalry or competition. We're always trying to see whether we are just better than the others, just as good as the others, whether we're able to stay on top. And then when we are able to rank ourselves as being on top, then we feel happy, or at least we feel gratified because of our superiority. But our smugness communicates itself to others. The smugness turns into a kind of stiffness. And in fact, the word that's being translated in our text as proud, the word tadda, actually originally means stiff. So we have the word tadda bhava is stiffness. And stiffness becomes pride. So when a person becomes proud, we can see, even we see a proud person's face, their muscles become tight, their bearing becomes stiff and rigid. So it leads to this kind of stiffness. And that stiffness, that rigidity, communicates a kind of defensiveness to others. And others pick up on that and feel a resentment. And because of that resentment, others come to dislike us. They try to avoid us. And so the proud person also becomes alienated from others. And then they become very lonely. Okay, so this is what happens to the proud person when they're on top. But the proud person isn't always on top. Sometimes others start catching up and getting ahead, particularly if one has a skill, an ability that depends on youth, strength. When younger people start developing their talents, they surpass one. One starts looking to the left, looking to the right, and wondering, what's going on here? They're getting ahead of me. And then when you see that others are getting ahead, we start to feel resentful, envious, humiliated. And then when they come out ahead of us, then one feels miserable. And so there's a saying, pride comes before a fall. So that's exactly the way it works. When there's pride, then others come out ahead, then there comes the fall, dejection, misery. And so when we have certain advantages, certain benefits, we have to extricate ourselves from this tendency to build up a sense of pride based on these advantages or benefits that we have. So how does one do this? Certain ways that might be recommended. One is, if we have the Buddha's teaching, we can use the Buddha's teaching as a kind of focus for helping to remove the sense of pride. One is to use the Buddha's teaching of non-self, anatta, to get over the sense of pride. So the sense of pride, feeling of pride, arises in the mind. That's quite natural. But what one does is to focus the idea, not I, not mine, not myself, on whatever one grasps upon as the basis for pride. Some maybe person has beautiful features, so physical beauty becomes the basis for pride. In that case, one considers one's own body. It's not mine, not I, not myself. Another person might have a lot of wealth, and they might, because of their wealth, they might be inclined to become proud. They consider the wealth is not mine, not I, not myself. Another person might be very intelligent. One considers the intelligence not mine, not I, not myself. Another person might be in a high position in society. One considers this position not mine, not I, not myself. A second method that can be used, again, employing the, call it the lens of the Buddha's teaching, is to view one's achievements, one's success, in the light of the Buddha's teaching of karma. So if one is, this applies particularly to achievements, accomplishments that come to one without much application of one's own effort. For example, birth in a high family, if without much investment of energy, one achieves wealth, success, one considers that this is happening through the workings of the law of karma. And one considers that this is the fruit of my good karma in the past. I shouldn't become just complacent about this, shouldn't become self-satisfied, shouldn't relax and become heedless, but rather I should use this, use my present advantages as an opportunity for creating more good karma right in this present life. And so in this way, having good opportunities here and now, one creates good causes in the present that will bring good benefits to oneself in the future. Okay, and a third strategy for overcoming pride, we might call it sublimating pride, when we have certain talents, certain gifts, certain abilities. We don't deny them, try to pretend that we don't have them, but we dedicate them. As Buddhists, we make them an offering to the triple gem, to the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. So if one has, some person might have, say, a gift or a talent for organization, for organizing. So one can use that talent for, say, organizing Buddhist meetings, Buddhist groups. And instead of trying to thrust oneself into the position of leadership, one tries to be humble, to keep in the background, but one uses these talents to bring people together and direct them into proper Buddhist practice. If one has the talent for, say, understanding and explaining the Dhamma, then one uses that gift, one makes it an offering to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. If one has, say, technical skills, skills with technical equipment, then one uses those skills, how to apply those skills to promote the Buddha's teaching and to benefit others. So whatever talents, abilities one has, one makes them into a humble offering to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and uses them to benefit others and to help to spread the Buddha's teachings. Okay, so these are a few guidelines on how to deal with pride, to prevent it from becoming a cause of downfall. Okay, now after the deity received this answer from the Buddha, it went on to ask another question. And now I'll just give the Buddha's answer. This question concerns the eighth cause of downfall. The Buddha replies, Iti duto sura duto akha duto chayo naro ladang ladang vinaseti tangpa rabhavato mukhang. Okay, in the translation, to be a womanizer, a drunkard, a gambler, and to squander all one earns, this is a cause of one's downfall. The Pali actually uses one word, one suffix attached to three other words. So it comes out a little bit more meaningful in the original Pali. Iti duto sura duto akha duto. So the suffix is the word duto, which means something like a wastrel, a squanderer, a dissipator. So one who is a squanderer on women, a squanderer on alcoholic drinks, a squanderer on dice, that's a squanderer on gambling, and who wastes, destroys whatever is gained, that is a cause of one's downfall. So this verse mentions three causes of self-destruction, which have such a widespread influence upon the whole society. I would say all the ways through history. In the Buddha's time already, this was a major problem. At the time of the Buddha, India was undergoing, had already undergone a transformation from being a predominantly agrarian society, and now towns and cities were springing up along the river banks. And so along with towns and cities of middle class and then a higher class originates, wealth becomes concentrated into hands of a small elite and then a larger middle class. And when wealth becomes concentrated, then there comes the opportunity for the squandering of that wealth on non-essential pleasures. And that happened in the Buddha's time, and now in our own time we find such a predominance of wealth, valuable wealth, lost in these three ways. First, we have a massive sex industry which thrives upon the exploitation of people's sensual interests. This aspect gets treated in more detail in the following verse. So I'll deal with that when I come to that verse. Then we have the problems with widespread use of alcohol. So, and by alcohol here, though the text speaks of liquor, the use of liquor, here we can take any kind of intoxicating substance that can be abused. So we would include here not only the alcoholic beverages, but all types of intoxicating drugs, including cocaine, heroin, the psychedelic drugs. There are probably many, many out there that I don't even know the existence of. But such large-scale illegal enterprises thrive upon these products. Heroin, cocaine, reaching from the Middle East, parts of China, Pakistan, that Afghanistan, that area, the Burma, the Golden Triangle is at Burma, the upper reaches of Burma, all the ways throughout the tentacles spread throughout the whole world, right to the cities of the United States, Europe, all over. And almost in any part of the world where people come together, one can find those who are addicted to these substances. The chains of distribution move with incredible effectiveness. They move through airports, through seaports. Somehow they manage to escape detection. And such large sections of the population, particularly the ones who seem to be the most vulnerable today, are young people. In the population, those who are in the age range, even below 18, a large percentage of even high school students have used drugs like cocaine, marijuana, some even heroin. And even though alcohol is a legal substance, but those who abuse the use of this substance are very, very numerous. And then again, there's this large-scale alcohol, the liquor industry thrives upon, even though it has the pretense of legality, but if one considers that how many people abuse alcohol without being detected, and large numbers of underage people, somehow they're able to obtain liquor through friends who buy it for them and then give it to them. And so large numbers of high school students drink alcohol regularly and even drive under the influence of alcohol. Then when one considers the number of deaths that take place through drunken driving, the number is quite astounding. And so the Buddha made it a very wise part of his ethical code to include abstinence from the use of alcohol as one of the five precepts. And the Buddha, in this verse, he's speaking about these three so-called sources of enjoyment: women, alcohol, and then the third one is gambling. This is another type of addiction, which seems to be innocent on the surface. It seems like a way of making quick wealth that doesn't involve any damage to one's body, unlike alcohol or drug use. It seems like a decent type of social fun. You come together with a group of people. You're just taking your chances. But gambling also has an addictive grip upon the mind. How it works, it's quite difficult to understand. But once people become involved in gambling, they become wrapped up in a cycle which is very difficult to break. It's not only that one is perpetually hoping to get rich by continuing to gamble, but it's the very thrill, the excitement of always hoping that the next time the lucky break is going to be yours. That constant thrill, excitement of anticipation, that I think is what has the gripping effect upon the mind and makes one continually come back again and again for more. And then once people start losing their wealth in gambling, then the hope builds up. The sense, first there comes a sense of despair that they can never get their wealth back in any other way. The only way that they can get enough wealth quickly in order to pay back their debts, to make up their losses and pay back their debts, is by winning through gambling. And so they go on gambling, go on playing whatever form it is, dice, cards, even speculation on the stock market, speculation with currencies. And if one looks at statistics, if one takes a statistician, they will learn that their chances of winning are actually extremely slim. But one always sees one person who wins, one knows that there's one person who wins, and there's always that hope that that person will be myself. And so one continues to gamble in the hope that next time the victory will be mine. Okay, these are three types of dissipation of wealth that the Buddha mentions against the background of his period. I could think of a few more that are relevant to us today. One that I would mention is compulsive shopping. True. Because in the Buddha's time, people would generally buy the basic necessities of life. They didn't have such a variety of goods. You didn't have advertising. Didn't have so much choice on the market. But now one has this enormous variety of commodities. You have such variety that you can choose virtually anything and everything. I remember a few years ago, somebody gave me a bottle of water, which was peach-flavored water. I said, "What is this peach-flavored water?" And he said, "Oh, this is only one flavor, but if you want, you can get blueberry-flavored water, apple-flavored water." And so you can buy different types of clothing, so many types of clothing, and every season the fashions change. For us, there's never any worry, never any change. It's always the same clothes going back the 2,300, 400 years. Then now with computers, every few months, if it's every year, every few months, they change the style. So as soon as one model comes out, immediately the developers are working on the next year's model. So if you're still using the 2004 model in the year 2005, you feel old-fashioned. You have to change in your machine to the 2005 model. Cars change every year, so you always have to, some people always have to have the latest model car. And so because of this, and then you have the shopping malls where people have to go every weekend. They feel that they have to go to the shopping mall to see what's on sale this weekend. And so people become addicted. They become compulsive shoppers. And then this leads to needless expenditures, building up of debts. And then this brings, they call it downfall, impoverishment, indebtedness, and a lot of difficulties. There's a sutta where the Buddha speaks about the proper use of wealth. Here the Buddha speaks, he's speaking to a family man, telling him how wealth should be properly used. He says, first, the wealth of the family. A householder should earn his wealth in a righteous way by energetic striving, energetic effort, not by speculation, by gambling, by exploitation of others, but in an honest, upright way, earn his wealth. Then he should use that wealth. First portion should be used to support oneself and one's dependents, one's wife, children, other members of the household, to support one's relatives. Another portion is put aside for, this would be the ancient equivalent of insurance. One uses this for protection against loss. Loss by fire, loss by floods, loss by kings. In those days, there were sometimes kings who ruled arbitrarily and who could just confiscate one's wealth without any warning. Loss on account of thieves. And so one would keep one portion safely hid away as a kind of insurance. Another portion should be used to make the traditional oblations. These are oblations to relatives, to guests, to the government. This would be the equivalent of paying taxes, and then for offerings to the devas, the deities, religious offerings. And then another portion is put aside in order to make offerings to Brahmins and ascetics, those who are leading the spiritual life. So this would be the portion set aside for supporting those who are leading the holy life, the spiritual life. Now we go to the next verse. This is verse number 18. Say he dare he asan tu to thesi asu padu. Padisati disati paradaresu tangparabhavato mukhang. Okay, translating from the text. Not to be contented with one's own wife, but to be seen with a prostitute or the wives of others, this is a cause of one's downfall. Here the Buddha is elaborating on the cause of downfall of one who's a womanizer. The Buddha teaches that the sexual drive is one of the most powerful expressions of craving. And so to overcome craving completely, what the Buddha recommends is the observance of the brahmacharya, that is complete restraint or celibacy. But for those who are not ready to observe complete restraint, he recommends the controlled expression of sexual desire through commitment to a single partner, that is, through a marital relationship. But within the marital relationship, the two partners to that relationship must be faithful to each other. And for one who has entered into the marital relationship, and here he's speaking in terms of the man, to then be going outside the relationship, having relations with other women, prostitutes, then going to the wives of others and breaking up, violating women involved in marriages to other men and having relations with them. That is to be transgressing against very heavy ethical codes, creating heavy, negative, bad karma that will bring a very heavy downfall, not only in this life, but in future lives. And so the Buddha issues a very strong word of caution against this. Then continuing along the same line in the next verse, he's going to speak about how a man could have a very difficult time within a marriage. Here, this is verse number 20. Atita yo bano poso aneti timbaru taning tasa isana supati tangpara bhavato mukhang. Herefore, a man who is past his youth, that's an older man, to take a young wife and then to be unable to sleep for jealousy of her, this is a cause of one's downfall. Now, in the Buddha's time, marriages were not always love marriages, but it was possible for a man highly placed in society, like a high-ranking Brahmin or a wealthy man, to take a wife, a young woman, by arranging it with her parents. And so it could be that an older Brahmin or a very wealthy businessman will choose a young woman, could be young. In those days, women were married when they were 14, 15 years old. So he could take a woman, a girl of that age, as his wife. And then, because the marriage is between two partners who are of such unequal ages, he's constantly worried that always that his wife is becoming involved with another young man, falling in love with a young man. So whenever he sees the wife talking to a younger man who might be even her brother, he's always suspicious that it's a love relationship. And he can never go out of the house because he's afraid if he leaves the house that something is going to happen between his wife and some young man that he doesn't know. So then a whole Indian body of Indian legendary literature has developed out of this, which I have to say is rather unfair to the women, that's always depicting how the young woman who's been married to an older man is getting involved in these adulterous love relationships with a younger man. In our modern society, it might be the case that the laws of love cannot be bound by any kind of fixed principle that the two partners always have to be of the same age. But I think it's a safe principle that two partners should generally be more or less within the same age range, that this age range should not vary too much, otherwise there would not be very close communication between the man and his wife, and then this can lead to dissatisfaction later in their marriage. Sometimes one reads in newspapers about a man of the age of 60 marrying a woman aged 22, 23. One wonders what's going to happen in 15 years when the man is 75, 80 years old, the woman is maybe just 35 years old. Can the marriage survive when there's such a great age difference between them? Okay, let us go on to the next verse. Iti sonding vikirining puri sangva pita disang isir yasmin tapeti tangpara bhavato mukhang. Okay, to read the translation, to place in authority a woman given to drink and squandering, or a man of light behavior, this is a cause of one's downfall. Actually, here I disagree somewhat with the translation, because the translation is not really saying cause of one's downfall, but it is saying this is a cause of downfall. The word ones is put in by the translator. And now the way I would read it is that there is a progression taking place. The earlier verses are concerned with causes of one's downfall, the downfall of an individual. But now, as we progress, we see the cause of downfall widening, the victims of downfall widening. And in this verse, the victim of downfall is not one, not an individual, but the downfall of a family. And in the next verse, we'll see that the victim of the downfall is a society or a country. So in this verse, the Buddha is speaking about what is the cause for the downfall of a family, and that is to put in a position of responsibility. He mentions first a woman who is dissolute, and it doesn't actually specify a woman who is given to drink. That is taken from, the commentary actually says, one who is dissolute on account of spending the money on drinking, on different types of expensive foods and other causes. So the main point is putting in charge of responsibility a woman or a man who squanders the money of the family, who doesn't use the money of the family properly. And the Buddha, again, he's speaking against the background of the Indian family of that time, where generally the husband would be the one who earns the wealth, but when he brings the money, the wealth, back to the family, he gives that money over to the woman, to his wife, and the wife takes charge of the money, and she is the one who is responsible for deciding how to utilize it. So that's why the woman is mentioned first. But then the verse also mentions a man, so it could be that the person in charge of the family might differ from one family to another, whether it's a woman or a man. But whoever is in charge of the family must use that wealth of the family properly. And the ideal way is the way that I mentioned just before, as the proper way to utilize the wealth. That is, to divide the wealth into four main portions, use some to make the family, to use it for the immediate needs of the family, use a portion for the insurance, use a portion to make the customary gifts to the guests, king, the deities, and then use a portion to support religious works. But to squander the wealth of the family, to use it irresponsibly, is a factor that brings the downfall of the family. And now we come to the last verse, extremely important, which speaks about the cause for the downfall of a country. Apabhogo mahatanho katiye jayati kule sodarajang patayati tangpara bhavato mukhang. If a member of an influential family or social or other group with vast ambition and of slender means seeks power or control over others, this is a cause of one's downfall. Okay, the way I see this, that this is actually the cause for the downfall of a nation when somebody who is greedy for power, yearning to get common to power, works his way up into a position of power and gets into a position of control and influence in the country, particularly if they get into the controlling chief position of the country, position of the chief executive, whether in those days a king, president, prime minister, whatever. Of course, that person having that lust for power deeply ingrained in the mind will never be satisfied with any amount of control. But once that person gets control over the country through the very lust for power, the very ambitious nature of that person's mind, they will be driven to seek widening areas of control and domination. And that will drive them to get control over the territory of others, to seek to conquer other countries. And so they will plunge their own country into constant warfare, overtaxing the citizens, drawing upon their own citizens, the young people of their citizens, drawing them into the armed forces, throwing their citizens into war, killing, destruction. And that will eventually bring the downfall of their country. And so the Buddha is here speaking against the very harsh realities of political life in his own time. And in fact, that has been the whole history of the human race right up to our own time. The history of how ambitious rulers have never been satisfied simply to govern their own countries, but have constantly been involving their own peoples in this incessant struggle for power and territory. Okay, and then finishing up the discourse, the Buddha says, I'll just read the English because our time is running out. Reflecting thoroughly on those causes of downfall in the world, the wise person endowed with insight enjoys bliss in a happy state. And this brings our explanation of the sutta to an end. I thank you all for your attention, and I wish the blessings of the Triple Gem on all of you. Okay, let us conclude by sharing the merit. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu mantarang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata ca amehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Okay, if there's any questions on anything arisen out of the talk, then please feel welcome to ask. Or if anybody has any comments to make, please feel welcome to make comments as well. Craig?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, the deva comes to the Buddha to ask a question, and the Buddha answers about things that maybe a deva wouldn't necessarily be interested in, like the household life of the earth. And what I'm wondering is, why? And why does he answer this way? Is there a commentarial description of perhaps the deva was asking because there's someone they were interested in who was still a human and wanted to be reborn in their realm, or was is there some explanation for why he answers a deva?
It's a good question. I don't recall whether the commentary gave an explanation of this point, but I should also say that sometimes using the deva to pose the questions serves as a kind of device for just drawing out a teaching in verse. So you could say that the deva functions as a kind of, there's an expression from Greek drama called dois, I don't know if my Greek pronunciation is correct, dois ex machina, which means using the deva just as a device to resolve using a deity as a device to resolve a particular crux in the plot of the drama. So having the deva come and ask the questions It's just a way of drawing out solutions to a problem from the Buddha. It doesn't mean that the deva, that we have to take this very literally as being the deva had some special interest in events taking place in the human realm. But again, there could be an actual explanation for this. I would have to go back and look at the beginning portion of the commentary. But I'll bear that question in mind and I'll look up that point. Is there...
I was wondering why also in number 16 when it talks about being a womanizer, drunkard, and so forth, you mentioned like compulsive shopping, for example, but I think maybe one of the topics also for teachers in here would be stealing. I mean, people steal for greed, I mean, they steal for many different reasons, and then when they do, they fall into the same three categories of womanizing, drunkard, you know, and gambling and so forth, because the more they steal, the more they spend.
There is such a thing as compulsive stealing, but I think stealing would be more like, I think like these are three channels for dissolution of wealth. Mm-hmm. Okay, stealing is an unethical way of acquiring wealth. Mm-hmm. But there is a sutta which speaks about four causes for the dissolution of wealth. And it mentions these three given here. And then the fourth is bad friendship, having bad friends. And then it uses a simile. The sutta uses a simile of a water tank. Of course, in India, people would, living in villages and towns, they would have their water accumulated through storage tanks. These large tanks that collect water. The tank has four inlets, four channels through which water enters, and then four outlets. And now if all of the inlets are blocked and the four outlets are opened, then the water flows out from the storage tank and is lost. So then the Buddha says, in the same way, having these three, getting involved in these four things, womanizing, drinking, gambling, and bad friendship. Those are the four causes for the dissolution of wealth. And so three of them are brought in here.
Could it possibly be earlier the great question that the devas were curious about humans?
It could just simply be curiosity, yeah.
Because in verse 1, it says, the Tama about a person who suffers downfall, meaning not them so much, but...
Yeah.
So maybe it's like a curiosity question, like, why do these people do these?
Yeah, it could be, yeah. Yeah. I had actually had along with the other causes for dissolution of wealth, I had a few other things listed that I didn't mention. Maybe some of you could have some ideas.
As far as devas go, a lot of devas were protective of human beings, right? So
a lot of them were
protective of human beings.
A lot of them were protective of human beings.
So they would like to get some knowledge as to, you know, who to take care of.
And a lot of them also were formerly human beings. But what are some other causes for the dissolution of wealth?
I have one thought, just maybe relevant or irrelevant, I don't know. As they say that anybody who wants to be a Buddha has to be a human being.
Yeah.
So this deity, who may be somewhere in some heaven, just as Siddhartha was a deity at some place, somewhere, then he descended on earth, became a human, and then became a Buddha. So could it be that this deity was kind of forestalling all those steps that he should have known, that what can cause downfall that he may be targeting to become a Buddha. Come down as a human, not be victim to any of such allurements, such things which can cause a downfall. So for his own purposes, he wanted to be enlightened.
It could be that. Also, it could be the reason I just thought of when you just brought that point up. It could be that that deity had compassion for human beings, and so he wanted to draw these explanations out from the Buddha in order that the sutta would come into existence and then would be passed down from generation to generation, so we would have a kind of clear guide of things to be avoided in order to protect ourselves from a downfall.
To answer your question, I was thinking maybe like greediness, like overeating, or maybe being too absorbed with the physical appearance.
Yeah, those are several of the things that, two things that I had. One was what I called a fashion addict. So that could also go under compulsive shopping, but this is a more specific version of that. Somebody is always just concerned to be in fashion, and so I have to say this is almost criminal in an age when so many people have just difficulty getting getting enough food to eat from day to day in so many countries. Africa, hundreds and thousands of people are on the verge of starvation, and yet people are changing their fashions, spending thousands of dollars every season just to keep in fashion.
Could it be possible that anything that a person does to enhance ego can lead to the dissolution of your will? Because
can you lead to?
To enhance your ego, things that people do, I mean, like the like your appearance or anything else that they do, if they have a brand new car, it's a self symbol. So anything that they do to strengthen this ego or self can lead to a downfall.
Yeah, okay, that's okay. He's asking, is it possible that anything that a person does to enhance their ego can be a cause of downfall? For example, buying a new car, a brand new car to enhance one's status, being concerned about doing things to improve one's appearance to enhance one's status, that could be a cause of one's downfall. I think that one could be carrying this too far, or one shouldn't carry it too far. I wouldn't say that if a person buys a new car, even if it's a high-class car, that it's necessarily a cause of downfall. And within the world, one could say that there are certain legitimate cases where people are entitled to use their wealth in ways that are in accord with their social position, as long as they have an attitude of, I would call this a kind of right view accompanying it, and a right attitude, a wholesome attitude, not getting swept away by it.
Yeah, but if you do it to, as we say, keep up with the Joneses, so when you constantly do this, I mean, you don't need a car, you just bought one last year, you know, et cetera, the clothes, the hair, the makeup, the whatever, you know, and you're just constantly doing it just so that your neighbor thinks that, you know, you're rich when you're probably hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt because you've squandered it all just to impress somebody.
Of course, if one is getting deep into debt and doing it just to impress others, then
right. It
is definitely, or one is already in a downfall.
Yeah, that would be squandering.
Yeah.
Andre, I just wanted to ask, the Buddha talks about, and David talked about relationships, between the man, the woman, the householder, and his wife, and the householder generally brings home the money in ancient India. And the wife, you said she is the one who's responsible for the financial decisions, or with the man, the or the household decisions. Would the woman be responsible? The householder gives the money to the woman, and the woman decides how that money is going to be spent, or how things are going to be bought for the household and things like that. That's true, you're saying, back in ancient India?
From several suttas, one gets the impression that the man brings home the money and gives it to the woman, that it's the woman's responsibility to safeguard the money. I would assume perhaps that the decisions of how to allocate the funds are made perhaps collectively or communally together by the man and his wife, rather than one person making all of the decisions on their own.
You're saying I didn't have that impression. I kind of thought that, the final stamp of approval that would go on anything involving the household would be brought to the husband or the father of the man.
I recall some texts would speak about the woman having the responsibility to safeguard the money. Perhaps you are right that it's the man who makes the decisions about how the money is allocated.
Because I was just wondering what you might think the Buddha would think of today, as far as generally, say, a woman being in that position. Maybe the man brings home the money, and the woman might even bring home some money too. But the woman is the one who calls the shots around the house, pretty much. And I just wondered what the Buddha might think of that generally.
The way the Buddha envisages the family, it is the woman who, as you put it, calls the shots around the house. The woman has the responsibility. But when the Buddha describes the management of the household, it's done conceiving the household as, we call this, a middle class or even upper middle class family in the India of that period. He's speaking to a householder, one with a true household, which includes a class of servants, workers, and all of them are under the management of the woman of the home. So the husband is responsible for earning wealth. He brings home the wealth, but it's the woman who manages the household, the domestic help. She supervises all of the workers of the home, the servants, the workers, the household workers. I would think she decides who is to get what work assignments, what things are to be done with the money from day to, how the money is to be utilized from day to day. Yes, I would think it's the woman who makes the day-to-day decisions regarding the expenditures of the money. Perhaps the general, you call it the general plan for the use of the wealth, is the decision of the man. And perhaps he allocates a certain amount to the woman to use for the management of the household, but then it's the woman who makes the decisions of what to draw from that supply and how to use it on a day-to-day basis.
I just want to add something to that. In those days, they had the joint families in India.
There would be large joint families or extended families.
The father, they handed the money over to the father or the mother, because all the brothers, all the sons and daughters, the sons lived together. So they usually handed the money over to the father, and then every son had to hand over his. They pack it to the father.
No, actually, then I would say the picture that I get from the description of the household in India is, once the sons grew up, they would go off and form independent families, and that they would not all pool their wealth together, but the sons would, once they married, they would be earning, and they would be raising their own families, and they would be using the wealth they earned to support their own families. Though they would all be living pretty much within the same area, and so they would be in constant contact with each other. Okay, we have to stop now.